The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
Podcast, a weekly discussion of current affairs in China, produced in partnership with SubChina. SubChina is the best way to stay on top of the important China news in just a few minutes a day, with a free email newsletter, a smartphone app, and at the website subchina.com. It's a feast of business, political, and cultural news about a nation that is reshaping the world. I'm Kaiser Guo, and this week on Seneca, we bring you a conversation that my co-host Jeremy Goldkorn taped back in November of last year when he was in his native South Africa for the Africa-China Journalists Forum, where he spoke to Dr. Bob Wekesa, a postdoctoral fellow at Wits Journalism in South Africa, and to Barry Van Wyk, who is project coordinator of the China-Africa Reporting Project at Wits Journalism. Enjoy the podcast, and over to you, Jeremy.
Barry Van Wyk and Bob Wekesa, welcome to the Seneca podcast. Today I spent a really interesting day with you and some of your guests at the Witwatersrand University Africa-China Reporting Project. There was a forum on journalism connected to the story of Chinese involvement in Africa and African involvement with China. Journalists from all over the continent and from China speaking about all kinds of issues. Can you give me a little bit of background about this project? You know, what is it? What do you do? And, you know, how was it conceived and carried out?
Hi, Jeremy. I think the basic idea of the Africa-China Reporting Project is to support and enable African and Chinese journalists to do journalism on what we now call Africa-China. This event today was really about putting Africa first. The more common designation is China-Africa, right? Is this what you might commonly hear? But for us in this project, we've now changed it to Africa-China, as in to put our African location, our African orientation, and the African interests that we have at heart, to put those first. So this was this event today, the Africa-China Reporting Project. We, in this project, have an event every year in which we bring journalists, African, Chinese, foreign journalists, together in one place to actually talk about the work that they do. And that is the event that you actually, Jeremy, as you were the MC of that event today, and that's actually what we had today. So you were asking me about the project. The project is a few years old.
It's probably in the interest of full disclosure, admit that I was the MC of your event.
You were there.
So, you know, I'm involved. I'm not an unobjective journalist in this case.
Yeah. So the what we now call the Africa-China Reporting Project is really now it's about 5, 6, 7 years old. What we do is we support African and Chinese journalists to do journalism on Africa-China. As we know, the Africa, the phenomenon, as you might say, of China's engagement with Africa is a very common thing. It's a very well-known thing. It's what everybody knows about. And yet it's something that not many people really understand very well. There's really a lot of information out there and a lot of misinformation as well. And this is really what we're trying to address in this project, to really support journalists to do proper journalism, to good, well-researched, well-thought-out, you might say, journalism. So we do this via a few activities. We give reporting grants to journalists all over the continent and Chinese journalists as well. We provide a network for them to engage with each other. We provide events like this. We do reporting tours, direct engagement. You know, if you can actually get journalists from China and from Africa to directly engage with each other. So we just a few weeks ago, we had a workshop for Chinese journalists in which we had about 10 Chinese journalists here in Johannesburg for 2 weeks, where we had lectures and training. And the direct engagement for these journalists to really understand, engage, is really one way that we thought this is a good way to actually advance Africa-China journalism, for this journalist to do proper journalism in a direct sense. So
So what is the worst? You mentioned misinformation. What do you think is the worst? And either of you take this question. What is the worst kind of misinformation out there? Because, I mean, from my perception, you have two types of really bad media narratives. On the one hand, you have China as the evil new colonist who's coming to Africa and is going to be, you know, worse than the European powers were and basically exploit Africa for her mineral resources and leave nothing behind. Mm-hmm. And then you have the other narrative, which is that, oh, this is the most wonderful thing, you know, China and Africa together, and both as victim, you know, former victims of colonial oppression, this is going to be hunky-dory and, you know, nothing will go wrong. And in between, maybe there's not so much. But I mean, that's my perception. What would you, the two of you, say are the worst types of wrong stories?
The thing is that China and Africa, China and the role that it's playing in Africa, it operates within these broad narratives. It's just inevitable that it is seen this way because of the history that we have of colonialism on this continent. China's role is inexorably seen in the same light. And that's really part of the problem. That's where the problem begins, because now, you know, that is immediately where you start from. That is how anything that China does in Africa is interpreted in that vein. So, for example, you take the issue of language. You know, it's an emotive issue in this country, on this continent. Inevitably, if Chinese is now a language that is being taught in South African schools, as many European other European languages are taught as well, inevitably this is now suddenly a controversial issue, and it is seen within those broad sort of, you know, one can say pseudo-colonial narratives.
Yeah, so actually at the forum today, was it Philip DeVette, the associate editor of the Mail and Guardian, was saying that the perception of Mandarin lessons being introduced into South African schoolrooms reminded him of, I mean, he didn't say it directly, but I think he was talking about black South Africans being forced to learn Afrikaans at school in the apartheid era.
You see, that's the kind of narrative that you start from. That is how these things are interpreted. So it's not really possible to do just straightforward reporting. Inevitably, there's some sort of backstory that has to be told, the journalism that has to be done here. In this project, and I'm just quickly going to link this to the Africa-China Reporting Project, what we do with this particular project is not to start from those narratives. What we do is to enable journalists to start on individual cases. What is happening in an individual case? So in this project, what we do is we try to bring out the voice of the communities, the voice of the people that are undergoing, the people of this continent who are undergoing this phenomenon of Africa-China engagement, the thing that is happening to them and in them and by them and through them.
So let's talk about some specifics. Can you maybe just briefly introduce some of the interesting stories that have been done under the auspices of your project?
Some that come to mind immediately is, you know, there is a few really interesting and good stories that can be told on China. You know, there's some good ones and there's some bad ones. There's good things happening and there are bad things happening. One of the good stories that are happening is in the area of public health. In West Africa, for example, we had a few journalists who were reporting from West Africa, and they actually go to these hospitals that China has built. And these, you know, we had a journalist in Cameroon who went around the hospitals that were being built there. For many people in those areas, these are the first well-built hospitals that they have access to ever. You know, this is just what is happening. This is some of the good story that China is able to tell here. People have access to medical care. I'm thinking now of a particular case from a journalist who reported from Cameroon, actually visited these hospitals, spoke to the people who attended these hospitals. And this is actually one of the good stories that one can tell about China in Africa. On the other hand, talking about Cameroon again, we had another journalist who did a story about logging, wood and logging, and this sort of thing, and how Chinese demand is creating this illegal activity of logging that's going on. It's actually really damaging to forests in Cameroon. This tells you just one sort of interesting example of how in one country, how various things are happening, contrasting things are happening, good things are happening, bad things are happening. And ultimately, what we try to do with this project is to get away from the overarching narrative and to get down to the individual case.
So more individual cases. So healthcare, another one.
Healthcare is one issue. Healthcare is happening in several countries. We had another case of healthcare that is happening in Zambia as well. But, you know, other cases that are happening as well.
Bad or good? I'm not asking for positive examples.
I think there's a case in Uganda where one of the, you know, journalists that we funded and, you know, gave support was looking at a copper mine that had closed many years back. with the arrival of China, Chinese funding, they were able to then, revive the, it's called Kilembe Mines in Western Uganda. And so with Chinese funding, there was a revival of these huge mines. Now the journalist approached the story by speaking to people who had worked at this plant when it had British funding, and spoke to them about how they were feeling, what it portended for them, what it meant for their future. And essentially, there was lots of excitement at the possibility that, the mine will roar back to life after almost a decade plus of being out of action. The big story that I think we had today at the forum, and which is also a big one in East Africa, is the so-called SGR, which stands for Standard Gauge Railway, from the port city of Mombasa through Nairobi towards, the rest of the East African region. And equally in this case, some of our grantees have actually gone to speak to Chinese workers there or people who live by the side of the railway who are affected in one way or the other. And therefore, through that, this huge narrative, this big story, this monolithic story of Chinese funding for this huge railway is broken down into the lives of the people that get impacted, get affected. And I think we could go on to, stories we've commissioned in Zimbabwe, diamond minerals in Ethiopia, and industrialization and the people who are benefiting from it in Tanzania, and, Tanzanian farmers were involved in supplying cotton to Chinese-built factories and so forth. And as my colleague mentioned earlier, our insistence is that these stories must have a local grassroots human element so that we break down this monolithic, huge, big story of pernicious and gigantic China coming to eat African lunch, as it were. So we have well over 50 stories that we can talk about.
And how about the different attitudes of the journalists involved? Because, I mean, you give grants to Chinese journalists and African journalists. Is there a gap between the way they look at the work of reporting and journalism? And, how different is it perhaps from journalists from Western countries, from the United States or Europe?
I think one of the things that we've learned from the project over the years is, one, that you can actually talk generally of nearly a Chinese approach, an African approach, a Western approach, in very generic terms. However, as came through today at the forum, and I think this is a thing that I can attest to as well, individual journalists can stand out in different ways. But if you wonder generic approaches, one of the things that we've learned is Chinese journalists usually tend, on arrival, to want to contact officials, for their stories as their sources and so forth. In fact, there's a project that we had here in 2010, which was really the first instance. And it so happened that it was over the period when we had World Cup here. So, at WITH Journalism Department. And so we tried to pair our Western Chinese and African stories to do one story related around the World Cup in South Africa. And it quite didn't work well because the approaches were very different from the various perspectives. Chinese journalists wanting to speak to officials, Western journalists wanting to just go straight into the street and speak to anybody they found, and African journalists kind of lost in between those two perspectives. And therefore, I think this has, and again, if you look at the stories, Chinese journalism is more, even from the ones that we've done at the project, they have this flair of writing in futuristic, way. I mean, high flown stories that are just very almost poetic. And you find that, many of the Western journalists that we've had, and Western is also huge, there could be individual differences. But as a generic comment, the Western journalists seem to be, hard-hitting, to the point, without much of too much flowery language and so forth. And again, African journalists will be lost in between there. And I think the final point one wants to make is that we must appreciate that there are limits that kind of hamper Chinese journalists from going the whole hog in this whole investigative journalism arena. And I think this remains an impediment in some instances. However, we have gotten quite some interesting revelations, some interesting insights from Chinese journalists because of their, you know, being well-placed to access certain sources that not other journalists can access.
So in Africa, they're able to do things that African journalists possibly aren't.
A good example is actually this whole rhino horn and elephant, you know, tusks story. Chinese journalists are able to, you know, access and reach, you know, kind of develop rapport with, you know, merchants, mostly sometimes quite often Chinese that are involved in the trade, in the illegal, you know, criminal trade.
And we're talking now about Shri, who is either before or after this podcast going to be on our podcast,
yes.
Who worked with the Namibian journalist John Hrobler, right?
Right, and in fact, in the other case, one of our associates and a fellow of the project is Hong Xiang, a very well-known Chinese journalist who has set up actually an NGO in Nairobi, pursuing these matters in various other, you know, approaches, who equally burst, you know, this kind of rings and this kind of underground criminal business in rhino horn and so forth, here in Joburg and elsewhere. So, yeah, the advantages on either side.
And you work with journalists from Chinese central state media, including the People's Daily, for example. How does that work? I mean, what do you think they get out of it, and what good does it do journalism on China-Africa issues to involve people who write for, say, the People's Daily?
No, I think the point that we make very clear for the project is that we are non-judgmental. We are value-free. We do not say state media is good and private media is not good or vice versa. So we kind of work with all journalists from state media and from non-state media. The thing is that by working with journalists from CCTV, from People's Daily and so forth, we get perspectives on where they are coming from. If we treated them as pariahs or people that we don't want to engage with, we will actually lose out on perspectives on how they approach things. In fact, we treat the project as a platform for discussion, engagement, exchange of ideas, and so forth. And through these, in fact, one of the things that one of the projects that we've done in the recent past has been to work with People's Daily to put together a Chinese business and South African journalists forum where, you know, very candid discussions were, you know, took place. And this actually then, you know, helps South African journalists to understand where Chinese business come from, for example, in not reaching them to make comments or not responding to their queries. On the other hand, People's Daily and Chinese businesses will understand where South African, you know, journalists come from, what drives them, what motivates them to write the way they do on matters China in South Africa. So I think we are open, and that applies to Xinhua News Agency, to CCTV Africa, and so forth.
What do you think are the biggest issues facing Africa in its dealings with China that need to be addressed by the media?
No, I think one of the biggest thing is, which we are still battling with. In fact, for people out there, we are very keen to understand how, if they have any perspectives that we could infuse into the projects to sort out this. Flattening the narrative into this whole big of a gigantic China coming to Africa with ill intentions, you know, a pernicious China that is has no benefits for Africa. And this often rolls out into prejudices of, for example, China as Yellow Peril, China as Dr. Fu Manchu, China as, just flipping things from where the West colonialists left it to, you know, kind of take out African resources without any returns or, you know, positives for Africa. On the other hand, there are also, kind of positive, stereotypes, you know, because stereotypes can be negative or positive. The positive ones will say, China is Africa's savior. China means only good. China is a win-win partner. You know, there's the language of mutual benefits, of reciprocation and so forth,
yes,
which are also huge narratives that we try to break down. And how we actually want to do this and what we've actually been doing for the last couple of months is to insist on a human grassroots approach. Where is the evidence, and where how does it affect the people? In fact, that now explains why we have a new logo that's based on the Chinese character of Ren, which means personality, people, humanity, and so forth, which is very closely allied to the concept of Ubuntu, which is African, also meaning the same kind of human nature.
Ubuntu is more than human nature, though, isn't it? Can you explain Ubuntu? Because most of our listeners won't.
I think one of the key understandings of Ubuntuism is that, in fact, it's captured in a statement where we say a person is a person through another person.
Mm. Yeah. I am because we are.
Yeah. Wherever you do anything, you must put the interest of the other person in mind. And so that you wouldn't want to do anything that will hurt the other person, just like you wouldn't want to the other person to hurt you. And therefore, it's a culture of sharing, of commonality, of focus on mutual interest, rather than the individualism which I think Western societies have been criticized.
So is this in fact a point of commonality between African cultures and Chinese culture? The fact that the individual is not privileged in the way it has been in the post-Enlightenment West, and particularly in the United States?
I'll say yes and no. In fact, you see, it's a very complicated thing. It is the similarity of concepts between Confucianism generally, as represented in a sense through the Ren character, as well as Ubuntuism. There's similarities there. But don't you forget that both the Chinese and African societies are undergoing very fast-paced dynamics where the West has some influence on both of them. So in a sense, you actually say, yes, traditionally, Africa and China have same kind of similarities in the focus on common interest, communitarian considerations. But what makes it even complicated is that we shouldn't even dismiss the West as entirely being individualistic.
West invented communism, after all.
Communism is also based on the same. So I think it is, that's the whole point, that we take certain symbolic considerations. Ren is a Chinese, recognized as a Chinese, communal kind of approach to things. Ubuntuism is recognized as such. If we have any other Western concept that, goes in that direction, well and good. But if you look at ideal, typical considerations, West is much more individualistic, in my opinion, than it is focused on matters community.
I think, you wouldn't have any argument from me on that. Okay, last question for both of you. What is the favorite story, just personally, your favorite story that has come out of your work on the Africa-China reporting project?
I think my favorite story will be Hongxiang's busting of the Rhino syndicate in South Africa, to the extent that it actually broke a story. There had been, cases where, a number of Chinese, Vietnamese, and, East Asian syndicates had been busted and people taken to court, sometimes let off the hook and so forth. But I think we hadn't quite gotten a situation where a journalist goes undercover and actually goes and, pretends to be one of the persons that wants to buy Rhino and so forth, and is given access and takes pictures, and then eventually all this go into print and we have some evidence. For me, it was a very powerful story. And I think perhaps the other story that has really made sense to me is the SGR story, the Standard Gauge Rail story that was done by Alan Olingo. It was quite a fantastic piece, and is a recent one. I mean, it to the extent that
Moses Wasamu.
Moses Wasamu, actually, yeah. And it went, because it went away from saying, look, there's this much money billions of money of US dollars has been pumped into the project. And, you know, it went beyond the huge narrative of China is using this to gain or this Kenyan government is corrupt and so forth. It actually went to humanize the story, as a colleague of ours said today, and bring out the people perspective that was entirely missing. And the guy had a flair of writing the story that was just quite captivating, so that, you know, you read, I mean, once you started reading it, you will want to stop reading it.
Jeremy, I think it's a hard choice to make. There are so many, but one that comes to mind is probably something that's similar to Bob's in a way, but it's written by a Chinese journalist. This one was written quite a few years ago, maybe 3-4 years ago, and it was written by a Chinese journalist, Chen Xiaochen. And he actually went to a sisal farm, a Chinese-invested sisal farm in Tanzania.
And sisal, like the kind of hampish,
yes,
substance.
Exactly. But what makes the story interesting, and it's quite a long feature, but it's a story that tells the travails, the challenges, the arduous challenges of this few Chinese farmers who set up this farm in Tanzania, not really having the support of anybody, really, not the Tanzanian government, really. There's not much support that was given them. These guys set up shops, set up farms, so to speak, in Tanzania, in this very rural community where there was nothing. There was literally nothing there. They set up the farm. They had, obviously, like they all do in Africa, they had labor issues. They had other kind of issues. And they pretty much persevered until eventually the farm sort of became quite successful. That is really, for me, was a story of adventure, challenge, and arduous experiences and great challenges in Africa and ultimate overcoming. I might just probably point out another one that is one of those stories that has a more sort of negative ring to it. We were talking about gold mining earlier, and this is one of those examples of where a whole host of Chinese gold miners came from the one gold mining community in China and went all the way to Ghana, setting up the gold mining small community in this in Ghana. And it's called, actually, they were called by the local name Galamzi, was the name given to them, which is sort of the semi-legal, pseudo-legal gold mining activities going on there. And this is interesting for another case, and this is another case of Chinese people, their experiences and their really great challenges of operating in Africa. This was an example of the gold miners in Ghana and just the incredible difficulties they had trying to navigate the very difficult environment of regulation, of police bribery, of just trying to get ahead, and also the complexity of it, because there's also the they found great resistance among the local community, who felt that they came there with their better technology, with their better means of doing the gold mining, and some people felt that they were actually more damaging to the environment. And I think what makes it such an interesting story for me is that ultimately what it brings out is this great complexity of what is going on around us, of the impossibility of seeing, you know, things in a simple binary, that it's China versus Africa or whatever the case might be. It's just a complex situation going on the ground. And sometimes you have it that these journalists are able to really go dig deep and bring out a complex, nuanced story of what's really going on.
Okay, before I let you go, I actually do have one last question for Bob. So you're from East Africa, you speak Swahili, you're not from the country south of Kenya, but how do you pronounce it? Is it Tanzania or Tanzania?
Tanzania.
Okay.
Right.
There we have it, the word from Bob. Barry and Bob, thank you very much, both for the Africa-China Journalist Forum today, which was a really great event, and for being on our podcast.
And thank you, Jeremy, for serving as the MC, and I think you did a great job, and thank you very much.
Oh, that's very kind.
Thanks.
Okay. All right. Now let's end this podcast and go and grab something to eat.
Is that on air as well?
And will it go on?
The Seneca podcast is powered by SubChina and is produced by Kaiser Guo and Jeremy Goldkorn. Special thanks this week to Anla Cheng and Soraya Darabi from SubChina. Drop us an email at seneca@subchina.com. Visit our Facebook page at facebook.com/Seneca Podcast and follow us on Twitter @Seneca Podcast. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week. Take care.